This on? Hello? Hello?
We're all science people.
Science.
Exactly.
We know it's a good idea because it's lasted.
There's chemistry in here. There's biology in here.
It's in whiskey. It's in ice cream. It's in who you fall in love with.
Rules.
And ethics and everything else.
We can make the world better for everybody.
Starting now.
Welcome to Science Rules. I'm your host, Bill Nye. This is the show where science rules. It's a call-in show. If you want to be on the show, please go to askbillnye.com and type on in. Tell us what's on your mind. And I am joined, of course, by science writer, editor, and dear friend, Corey S. Powell. Hello, Corey.
Bill, great to be here with you.
When I was getting excited about being an astronaut age, I was 9 years old. I took my first trip to New York, New York. The town's so nice, they named it twice. To the World's Fair. This is before the internet, people. We would have these big exhibitions. Corporations and governments from around the world would put on display their finest efforts, the future, about the future, and so on. And the United Nations had a total board, a totalizer, a scoreboard, depicting the presumed or estimated number of people on Earth, human population. And we had just missed it, changing from 2,999,999,999 people to 3 billion people. Well, today they're well over 7.5 billion people. By 2050, there'll be 9 billion people. And they're all going to want to do what, Corey?
I would imagine they're all going to want to eat.
That's right. Food. And so I wonder, I say to myself, Bill Nye, host of Science Rules, guy, how are we going to feed all these people? And I think about that when I'm eating. And of course, when I'm eating, I also think about science. I think about cooking. I think about what changes to food when we heat it. I think about boiling water and the little bubbles of water vapor. It's exciting. And so to discuss this, we have a guy who is fascinated, perhaps obsessed, with humans' relationship to food. That's right, people, from The Sporkful, none other than Dan Pashman.
Thanks, guys. Oh, that's a very advanced sound effect you have there, the applause. Very nice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Speaking of which, Dan.
Yes, sir.
Greetings. Why do you do The Sporkful? What goes on The Sporkful?
Well, so it's a podcast, and I love to eat. And
oh, really?
Yes,
tell us about that.
I really, really, really get a lot of pleasure from food. So I started this podcast 9.5 years ago, basically in my living room, because I love to eat. And our slogan for the show is, it's not for foodies, it's for eaters. And I love to obsess about the tiniest details of the eating experience. I love to interview comedians and celebrities about what they're eating and learn more about other people, other cultures, and get into sometimes serious issues of identity by talking about food. So, and we do food science, a lot of food science.
So speaking of food science.
Yes.
Have you thought a lot about the effect or the impact of 9 billion people trying to eat on the Earth's surface?
For sure. Yeah.
And do you see it as a piece of cake, pun intended, or a great challenge?
No, 100%. It's certainly a big concern for all of us. And there's the issue of food waste. There's the amount of effort that goes in. You know, every bite of food that we take, there is an impact on the planet to produce that bite of food. Some bites of food require more effort and impact than others. And then to put in a lot of effort to food and then have some of that food go to waste is even worse.
I'm not joking. Do you say grace or a form of grace before you eat?
I don't. My friend Eddie Koblenz, my best friend growing up, his family always did. And when I would go there for dinner, I would always forget that they did that and I would start eating by accident.
And look, you're fine now. No, but
there's
a lot
to it.
There's a lot to it, to taking that moment to appreciate all the effort that goes into producing any sort of meal. I mean, anything. And this applies from, what did we have today? Cups of tea. Tea leaves are grown on farms on the other side of the world, and yet they're commonplace, and we take it for granted. Just heating up the water to make the tea, or more importantly, perhaps the coffee, it takes tremendous amount of energy that's somehow available to everybody. And so we can't take this for granted, man.
100%. And I certainly have made an effort to eat less meat than I used to, you know, partly for health and partly for environmental reasons. And so I try to eat less. I eat probably 50% less meat than I did 10 years ago.
So if you, everybody, if you want to be a vegetarian, the old saying is start with one night a week.
Right.
And work your way out, if that's your thing.
Yeah, I set a resolution, like it used to be, that I would have like a turkey sandwich for lunch and then some kind of meat for dinner. Like there was always meat at lunch and always meat at dinner.
What'd you have for breakfast?
I would either have like cereal or no breakfast.
Would you have an egg?
Sometimes.
See, that's three. That's three sources of animal protein.
Animal protein, right. Depends on whether you want to count that as meat, because you don't have to kill an animal in the process.
No, generally not. In fact, if you do, you get a lot fewer eggs.
You're kind of doing it wrong.
Right.
But I resolved that I would only eat meat at lunch or dinner as many days as possible.
So, that's cutting it in half, right. Just shooting from the hip.
Right. And I've been pretty good at keeping that up.
So, Dan, I know this is often a question that people have is, you know, how do you remain mindful about all these things about your food but still enjoy your food, you know, not feeling guilt all the time? Do you find – does being aware of all those other issues, does that interfere with your pleasure or does it maybe even enhance your pleasure?
Once in a while it interferes. There are days that I feel guilty about things I'm eating, but it's – probably infrequent. I would say,
what sort of guilt do you feel?
Well, like, actually, you know, when I feel more food guilt is when I waste food.
Okay,
That makes me feel guilty.
So I give you three types of guilt.
Okay.
Wasting food.
Right.
Then guilt where you've eaten something you feel you shouldn't have eaten. Right? And then you eat too big a dessert.
Right.
So you feel bad about yourself.
Right.
Then the third one would be when you've done something to the world. Where you've eaten meat that's made by a cow that used too much water to be produced and the poor cow and so on.
Right. I would say definitely I sometimes feel guilty if I waste food. And that sometimes I deal with the fear of that guilt by eating food that I don't even want to be eating so that I don't have to throw it in the garbage. And then I overeat because I wasn't even hungry. And then I feel guilty for overeating.
And you have kids and that's what you do, right?
Right. Yeah. And then I've earned, like my father before me, Bill, I have been nicknamed the human garbage disposal.
Be proud.
It's the circle of life.
Yeah, we call it it's the dad cleaning process. Right. You know, just whatever's on the table, hey, you know, that stuff's not going to waste.
Right.
So as I mentioned earlier, this is a call-in show, AskBillNye.com. Corey, looking over to you in your direction, I see that we have callers.
We do. We have a caller named Nicole. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, you are on with Bill and I.
Hi. So this question came up last year when I was teaching marine science and we were talking about cold, dense, salty seawater. And somehow it led to a teacher who taught near me, who liked to be the smartest person in the room, saying that the reason why people salt their pasta water is to lower the boiling point so that it will boil faster. And I have learned since then that a lot of people think this. So I don't know where that came from. Do you think that salting the water has any effect on flavor or temperature?
So, Nicole,
this person wrong.
This is, as yes. Corey pointed out, this is a fabulous question, I think, near and dear to all pasta enjoyers.
Yes.
Dan, among which you are whom, if I may construct it for
big enjoyer,
effect.
Big enjoyer, yes.
And so why do you feel, because I got strong opinions here on physics, but why do you feel we salt the pasta water?
Well, in terms of the science, I'll defer to you, Bill. I have heard the same thing, that putting the salt in the water makes it boil faster. So sometimes I put salt in water when I'm making like hard-boiled eggs, just because I thought it would make it boil faster, but I'll let you tell me
no,
if that's true. But I do want to say that salt in water for flavor absolutely makes a difference. And when you're making pasta, you absolutely should salt your water liberally with more salt than you think you need, and it will make your pasta taste much better.
Just because it's got that salt mouth-stimulating jolt of sodium ions.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Corey.
Yes, Bill.
You're a science reporter with years of behind the keyboard.
A veteran, one might say.
So do you have a strong opinion about the salt and the boiling? Because I do. Strong opinion about salt and boiling.
My opinion is that the mansplainer here might be a little bit off base.
One second. Nicole, was this this person presenting this information to you unsubstantiated, was this person a man or a woman?
They were a man.
Okay.
So he was mansplaining.
Yes.
Well, thank goodness Nicole has called three other men to ask the question.
But we're only going to people-splain here. This is the nature of this show is we only people-splain.
Okay, thank you.
Salt does, you know, it lowers the specific heat of the water, which
so
would,
the, heat,
which
the would, water can hold less heat,
which would make it boil a little more easily. But it also, you know, salt in general, adding extra things to the water raises the boiling point. The thing is, both of those effects are very, very small. To appreciably change the boiling point, you'd have to add probably like 100, 200 grams of salt. It's a lot of salt.
To a liter?
To 1 liter 10, of water.
10 or 15, 20% of the mass of the thing would be salt.
Right. You'd have to be really dumping salt in there to have a big impact on the boiling point.
But here's where I think the myth originates, Nicole, and thank you so much for calling. When you may have seen or encountered a beer, or perhaps more importantly, champagne. The key there, what makes it so delicious, is taking the vapors into your nose, and this is done by making the champagne sparkling, by having organisms in the process, in the fermentation process that produce this gas, and the bubbles that form on what physicists like to call nucleation sites, where the bubbles nucleate, where they form a center, where they form a nucleus. So if you have very hot water, it's sitting there on the stove, getting hot, getting hot, getting hot, and you put in a couple tablespoons of salt with its rough edges, its sharp crystalline corners, then the thing will start to boil immediately. You can get it superheated, as it's called, take it just slightly above its boiling point before bubbles start to form. And so when you put the salt in, wham, it starts to boil. And so this could easily lead to a reproducible phenomenon that would cause a human to conclude that the salt caused it to boil, which is true. But then you would take it one extra unsubstantiated step and say the salt caused it to boil sooner.
And I think the most important thing I take away here is that salt in your pasta water makes the pasta taste better.
Yes.
I think that is the only I think that is the thing that really matters.
But so wait, let me understand, because I've had the exact experience you described, Bill, that I have added, especially like when I get impatient, the water's already been on the stove
There's
for a while.
There's old sayings about
it's
watching pots, Dan.
A watched pot never boils, but a watched pot with salt added does seem to boil. And so what is happening then if it's not altering the boiling temperature?
Oh, so let us keep in mind, you know, people say it's like watching paint dry to describe something that would be disenchanting.
Right.
Or it's like watching water boil. I encourage everybody to do both. Someday, watch water boil. It is astonishing. It forms tiny little bubbles, and then it forms bigger and bigger bubbles that bubble to the surface. And if you don't believe me, try holding a match, a lighted match, above your boiling water. It will go right out because what's coming out of what the bubbles are forming, they're not bubbles of air. Those are not bubbles of air, peoples. They're bubbles of water vapor, another gas that's around us all the time, between me and the microphone, between you and your loudspeaker situation, earphones, Nicole, is water vapor. And it's another separate gas that does not sustain combustion. And it comes out of the boiling process. And it's just cool.
Okay. So Nicole, that's a great experiment for you to do. Nicole, are you yourself a pasta water salter? Are you a user of the salt method?
I am, but I only have ever heard of it for flavor, except one time when I was watching an episode of Chopped. And one of the contestants said that a mentor had told them to never salt their pasta water.
Oh, I am open-minded, but very skeptical.
Yeah, that's wrong. That's just wrong.
There are a lot of maniacs in the world. I think that's what we can conclude.
So, Corey, along this line, someone you're very close to, I believe she's your wife.
Yes, my wife, the doctor.
Is it true that you're very close with her, Corey?
You know, we'll continue this conversation after the show.
But she's a physician.
She is.
And she has opinions about salt.
So a lot of people stay away from salt. Like the person who's probably telling you not to salt the water or saying, you know, we have too much salt in our diet. Salt causes hypertension. This is sort of a well-worn trope. But apparently, if you're not actually diagnosed with hypertension, if you're not already at risk of serious high blood pressure, for most people, your salt intake really does not matter that much. You can have a lot of salt in your diet, and you're fine.
And Dan, you insisted, it sounded like. put in a lot of salt.
Yes, and I have heard this from some of the nation's foremost pasta minds that you need a lot of salt in that water, because when you bite into that, you know, you're going to put sauce in your pasta, but when you take a first bite out of that pasta, hot out of the boiling water, there are two things you're tasting for. One is the texture. You want to make sure that it's firm and toothsome. Tooth-sinkable is the technical term I like to use.
Tooth-sinkable.
Yes.
This is in your mouth.
This is beyond al dente. This is a higher level language.
It's a more scientific term for al dente.
A spectrum of tooth sinkability.
Right. Yes. Tooth sinkability. That's right. And then you want to taste for the flavor. You know, and the flavor, it should be a little bit salty. Pasta should taste good plain. Sure, you can add other stuff to make it better. But if it tastes totally bland coming out of the pot, then it's
you're
a
looking
problem.
At nothing. You're looking at nothing. Nicole, thank you so much.
That's a great question.
Inspirational. Thank you.
Thank you.
I love this next question. As someone who is fascinated by the future, I'm very fascinated by this next caller who wants to know about lab-grown meat. We have Dub, and let's see. Dub, are you there?
I am here. Thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate this.
Thanks for taking the time. Dub, lab-grown meat.
Thank you, yeah. Yes, sir. So my question, how far away are we from affordable, clean, lab-produced meat? I have a diet of a high protein, high fat, seems to work really well for me, and it really works best when filled with animal protein, but just kind of like you guys were discussing earlier, there's, you know, the battle of the ethics behind it, or the guilt behind where the meat comes from, so this intrigues me quite a bit.
So I have, on the electric TV machine, I have tasted lab-grown meat, and it tastes exactly like meat. So what researchers have done is get the stem cells of meat and grow them in culture, and they produced a hamburger that right now would cost hundreds of dollars per burger, or a fraction of $200 per burger.
It's basically like Jurassic Park, right? Like they take a little bit of DNA, essentially, or cells from a real live animal, and then they grow it in – they take those cells and grow them into – actual meat,
yeah,
without
right.
growing another new animal.
That's right.
Basically, you're growing the muscle of the cow without the rest of the cow.
There's right. no baseball glove leather, no intestines, no cat gut for guitar strings,
and
none of this.
And no cow mind, whatever a cow mind is.
No cow mind, yeah. Yes. Mind of a cow. So I tasted it, and it's remarkable. It's just like meat. But then there are people that were in the audience that were as creeped out by eating lab-grown cells as eating animal from a whole animal cell. Furthermore, recently I was with my friends at the Union of Concerned Scientists, and we visited this lab where they have found a protein and a molecule they refer to as the heme, having to do with hemoglobin and iron. And so they found they can insert this genetically, the genetic modification of crops, and get it to get a, for example, a soy product to taste like meat. So when I think about the cost of this hamburger right now, getting back to this one idea, thank you for calling, Dub. When you get back to the cost of the hamburger, it's $100 right now. But if you were making them on McDonald's scales, you got to think it would be cheaper, far cheaper. I mean, pick a number, a hundredth of the cost of raising a whole cow on a giant farm. So I can imagine, as research continues, Dub, that this will become affordable in one form or another. And by that, I mean either in a derived vegetable form or in a derived animal form. I mean, we are all one of the insights of Russell and Darwin is, near as anybody can tell, every living thing you've ever met is descended from a common ancestor. So we all have DNA. We've all got this thing. So it seems to me there's some convergence coming. So, Dub, stay tuned. I am confident. I predict here early in the 21st century that laboratory-style or industrial-style satisfactory meat products will be available at reasonable cost.
And, Dub, am I correct that that's something that you're waiting for? You sound like you're eager for the lab-grown burger rather than creeped out by it. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. No creepiness factor that at all.
I mean, it's so funny to me that what we consider creepy and then not creepy. These things are so subjective, and they're so can be so different in different cultures around the world. I mean, the idea that like taking a chicken's leg and biting into it is totally normal. It happens every day.
That's a normal thing to do.
Right, exactly. But yet, like, taking this thing out of this Petri dish is totally bizarre and strange. You know, like, well, you know, I don't know. When you really think of it as an actual chicken's leg, I think that seems more creepy.
Yeah, it's pretty creepy. Furthermore, let me ask you, Dan, you've eaten everything everywhere, right?
I've covered a lot of ground.
So compare a lobster or a crab. In New England, this at one point, the lobster was considered such a junk fish that it was not allowed to be fed to prisoners more than twice a week. You
right.
Heard the story.
It was called the cockroach of the sea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then people eat cockroaches. Or,
right, exactly.
Or
crickets.
Yeah, things. Crickets. What am I looking for? Orthoptera blatidae in your insect family and, I mean, order and family. So you've eaten a lot of crickets?
I have tried some. I wouldn't say a lot. I will be honest. I got a little bit of an insect phobia.
You got creeped.
Right. But like, I wouldn't judge other people, certainly. Like, it doesn't, like, it intellectually, it makes total sense to me.
Eat a crab, eat a cricket.
Yeah. Like, and I have eaten some. Like, I've eaten crickets on top of ice cream, and they were crunchy, and it was fine.
I've eaten a lot of termites.
What do you think of those?
Well, they're fine, because they were prepared in, how to say, like, you would prepare chuck roast meat with garlic mm-hmm. and other conventional seasonings, and they are crunchy and quite satisfying. Quite satisfying.
Oh, yeah.
And let me tell you, there's no shortage of termites, people. It's not happening.
Toasted mealworms were also quite good. We tried that out on the Bill Nye Show on Netflix.
Yeah. So this is Dub. You have raised an excellent question, and you just think about how we've industrialized agriculture already, and people are concerned or critical of industrial agriculture, but that's how we feed 7.5 billion people instead of fewer than a billion. You know, my grandparents, in my great-grandparents' time, there were fewer than a billion people in the world. Now there's going to be 9. Speaking of which, thank you, Dub.
Stick around for more science rules after this. You're listening to Science Rules.
Derek, you are on the show.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my question.
Thank you, Derek.
Thanks, Derek.
My question is, why is ketchup a non-Newtonian fluid?
Oh, cool. Well, that's simple enough. So everybody...
You've clearly called the right show.
He's. What does he mean, Dan? He's saying, why is ketchup thixotropic? That's what he's saying. Of course it is.
That's how I heard it. Yeah.
So anyway, you guys... There's something called a Newtonian fluid named after Isaac Newton. And Isaac Newton, who was this guy? He discovered or quantified, as far as anybody can tell, was the first guy to write down the idea that not only is the earth pulling the apple down, but the apple is somehow ever so slightly pulling the earth up. And he's sitting around musing in Latin. You know, it seems to me our sun is really a star, just like all those other bright points of light. Huh, interesting insight. Have a nice day. What? What did you say? And then along with that, he investigated fluids, stuff that flows. And we're talking about oil and water, and he had these two concentric cylinders, like cans, and he'd spend one inside the other and watched how much drag he created.
And this is before we had ketchup in its modern form. Is that correct?
And yeah, and he even... In order to solve the problem and understand it, he invented a calculus, a type of math involving an infinite number of infinitely small things. Wow. Along with that, we use the modern expression Newtonian fluid, like an oil, like water, like air is generally a Newtonian fluid. But toothpaste and ketchup, do not behave like Newtonian fluids. And so there's something about the molecules, their length, and the way they link together that makes them stay pretty well stuck until until you shear them. And you know what shearing is, everybody, because you've used a pair of scissors. And shearing is where one surface is going one way and the surface next to it is going the other way. And so the toothpaste or the ketchup sits in the tube or the bottle until you give it a jolt, until you stress it, until you shear it. And so then the toothpaste comes out like crazy, and the ketchup comes out like crazy. And the furthermore fabulous thing, Jacob, about your insight here, Derek. Somebody discovered or reasoned or screwed around with ketchup enough to design a bottle that's wide at the bottom and tapered near the neck, near the outlet of ketchup. So you have to really whack on it to induce enough shear for the ketchup to come out. And when it comes out, I won't say in a catastrophic way, but a lot of ketchup at once. And this has wonderful properties for hot dogs, or vegan hot dogs, impossible hot dogs, and impossible fries, and French fries, or pommes frites, whatever it is. And so the reason is, as we say, a magician would say what, Corey, Dan? A magician say it's all done with?
Magic?
With mirrors.
Oh, no.
Yes. But the chemist says it's all done with molecules.
Ah.
And that's hilarious.
I see where you're going.
That's hilarious. But it has something to do with the interaction of the sugar, which has these OHs hanging, these hydroxyl groups hanging on the edges of the molecules, and the water that's in there where it bonds, and then it shakes loose when you give it enough shear. And just think what a mess it would be to try to deal with toothpaste that just came out of the tube as soon as you unscrewed it. It would be of no good. You would not be pasting.
Isn't it something about a non-Newtonian fluid like ketchup that it takes a long time for it to start moving?
That's what I mean.
But once it starts moving, it tends to increase in velocity.
Yeah. Once you get it shearing, off it shears.
Right. So you get the weight, and then you get the incredible gratification. Yeah. So now, Derek, are you a fan of thick ketchup? What on earth prompted this question?
I was always given ketchup as the example of what a non-Newtonian fluid is. And everybody, you know, with ketchup being so ubiquitous, you know, it's really easy for people to understand how a non-Newtonian fluid behaves if you think of it like ketchup. What I never understood really was why ketchup is non-Newtonian. If you think about the ingredients, it's mostly water, it's salt, it's sugar, it's, you know, vinegar.
That's a good question.
So what... I invite a listener, an expert on this, to check in, but I'm pretty sure it has to do with the interaction of water and sugar. And sugar is this disaccharide, has two sides, di-sides. And so the water, which is HOH, H2O, and the disaccharide has these OHs, oxygen hydrogens, hanging off the side. And there's some fabulous interaction between the distance on like a benzene ring where six carbons are in a circle.
Bill, you're going deep here.
Well, there's some interaction with the distance between the corners of the ring and the length of a water molecule. But it is, everybody, you can experience non-Newtonian fluids with ketchup. And there's this fabulous old word somebody coined, thixotropic. It moves in a thix way. Come on, what a great word, thixotropic.
Now the kids just say, that ketchup is thick.
That's what the kids just say.
Not as good, though. Yeah. That word's not as good.
And does anybody say lit-a-tropic? Not yet.
No, I think that's over.
But I think that thixotropic is a great band name, Bill. I think if you want to take that on the road.
Well, we could, but I guess it was really their first album.
And then for their older stuff?
Yeah, thixotropic, they're kind of overproduced.
How about Bill Nye and the thixotropics?
So if it were a basketball team, would it, like, the Jazz?
Right.
Would it just be thixotropic? Would it be the thixotropic?
I think it would be the thick. I think it would be like the heat. It would be like the thick.
Anyway, yeah. Derek, you started all this, and thank you so much.
Thank you for taking us there.
Thank you.
Let's see. Larkin, are you on the line?
I am. How are you?
We're good. We have a question we would like to answer.
All right. So my question is doesn't have as many moral implications as all of your big picture questions.
Excellent.
It's a simple one. When I melt butter in the microwave, say for popcorn or something like that, I have noticed that sometimes it melts really quickly. And sometimes, even if I chop it into tiny pieces, it takes ages to melt. Like, I'm hitting the 30-second button over and over and over again. I can't tell if it's a temp thing or a microwave thing or a salted versus unsalted thing. What do you think's going on?
Okay. I'm going to be very skeptical of salted versus unsalted. Now, we are not there with you. We cannot enjoy this, Larkin, your butter endeavors. But how much flipping butter are you melting at one sitting where you're punching the 30 thing more than once? Like, if I have in my, just talking again about me, if I have a stick of butter and I want it to be soft, I go 6-7 seconds in the microwave and you're going to get it to sliceability. When you want to melt it to include in a recipe, or perhaps more importantly, pour on popcorn, then you're into your 35-40 seconds, but you're not into your 2 minutes. How much?
That's what you would think, but I am taking, you know, maybe a quarter stick, half a stick of butter. I have a nutrition degree, so I try to be mindful of the butter, and I'm chopping it into like quarter-sized pieces, and it is not melting.
Now I have another hypothesis for you, Larkin. Different areas of your microwave have different intensities of microwave radiation, flow of microwaves. So next time you are confronted with this, and I think you have to work backwards, if I understand it, you have to find a stick of butter that's not melting very well, move it literally to another part of the microwave, another part of the turntable or the center of the microwave. And I cannot help but wonder, none of our business, of course, but are you keeping the butter in, say, a Pyrex pitcher and it's in the refrigerator and you take it out of the refrigerator and so the heat capacity of the Pyrex pitcher has to be overcome before the butter's going to melt? I'm just wondering.
Not usually. It's usually in a bowl, like just a Corelware bowl.
Love the Corel. Not that I'm a spokesperson, but it's a great product as a result of understanding ceramics. So keep us posted. But next time it doesn't melt, try moving it to a different area, a different place on the microwave turntable or bottom plate.
Right. When in doubt, scientific method, change one of your variables, examine the results.
And the hard thing for all of us is to change one thing at a time.
Yes.
We all change three things, and then you can't figure out what happened.
Yeah, that's true.
Larkin, this is a great report to us. Let us know what happened. Thank you for your question.
I'll tweet at you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, that's what the kids
that was great.
Do with their electric internets. Yes.
Science Rules will be right back. Science Rules is back.
What do we got, Corey?
That's a question from Julie. And here, Julie, you're on the air. Go ahead and ask your question.
Well, hello. My question is, why do we like more food the older we get? What's happening in our mouth?
Wow.
That's a great
question. Dan, you're the man for this. You have kids, and you're not a kid as much anymore as you once were.
I mean, I think the short answer is exposure. I mean, yeah, and there's a lot of research done on food aversions. Why do people dislike certain foods? How can you learn to like a food that you don't like? And the short answer that sensory scientists will tell you is exposure. So, you know, start off by exposing yourself in small amounts. We actually did an episode of The Sporkful recently about picky eaters called In Defense of Picky Eaters. We got into a lot of the science on picky eating. One of the things I learned is that it can take someone 30 or 40 tastes of a food before they acquire a liking for it. And so I think mostly what's happening in this case is just that, like, the first 30 times you tried it, you didn't really like it. But then finally, it's in small doses. It ends up in a few things that you eat by accident or at a friend's house. And then finally, you know, your eyes are open to it. I've acquired a taste for a lot of foods in my 30s and 40s that I never liked when I was a kid.
Now, when you're a kid and you're being a picky eater,
right?
Are you doing that because you really don't like it, or is it a way for you to embrace that 2-year-old discovery that you can say no?
Certainly that's part of it. That's definitely part of it. The most common ages for picky eating are around age 3 to 6, but there's also a good evolutionary argument to explain why kids might be you know, it might be natural and normal for little kids to be picky eaters. You know, go back to cave person days and we were wandering through the forest. You know, the 3-year-old who put any berry in their mouths without knowing what the heck they were eating was not likely to live long enough to reproduce. Whereas the kids who were naturally suspicious of new foods and only ate the foods that they were comfortable with and that they knew they really liked were the ones who were more likely to survive. So I think that some amount of skepticism of new foods makes evolutionary sense.
And you see, evolution, without evolution, biology just, it doesn't make any sense.
But I also think, you know, from a, just from a, like a, like a social or cultural point of view, imagine, you know, kids experience what their, you know, their parents and their sort of immediate social circle eats. So, you know, that defines what's familiar. And there's a common thing that, you know, foods from other cultures seem strange or they kind of, you know, evoke a yuck factor. But again, you know, that makes sense if you think about, you know, how you get socialized, that you're used to, you know, your immediate family or your immediate clan. They define normal. They define your world. And then as you start traveling, you get acclimated to other cultures and other groups. Their foods also become more familiar to you. So I think there's a certain natural thing there as well, that, you know, as your social world gets bigger, your culinary world or your palate gets bigger as well.
So also there's commonality culture to culture. Is this true? We have naan, we have flatbread, we have pizza, we have samosa, we have...
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are some universals and some basic ingredients that are all that are in many, many parts of the world. But there are also big differences. But one of the things that I think is so interesting is watching, you know, as a, when a newer immigrant group comes to America and brings their food culture with them, often that food is at first viewed with some amount of suspicion, as are those people. And then over time, as the people assimilate, so too do the foods, and they become, quote unquote, less threatening over time. I mean, you look at sushi. I mean,
would you look at sushi?
In the 1960s, when Japanese food was first taking root in America, most Americans thought that the idea of eating raw fish was totally bizarre and strange and foreign and
creepy.
Weird. Yeah. Creepy, yeah. And now we're eating it up, you know, by the handful. We've acquired a taste for it, and we've learned that it's amazing and delicious. You look at the number of spicy foods that we eat now, you know, that are not part of a typical Western European diet. Look at all the snack foods that have spicy flavors now, the spicy Doritos, the spicy chips that are everywhere. Look at sriracha. This is the influence of newer immigrant groups that tend to have spicier foods. And, you know, it's making and so all of us are, you know, as a country, we our palates are being opened up to more new flavors.
Well, so here's a question. Does that flow go the other way? If you eat more adventurously, do you think that opens up your cultural perspective in other ways? Does that make you more open to other kinds of people?
It certainly would. Intuitively, that would be a testable hypothesis.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to speak on behalf of other groups, but this is something we've talked about on the Sporkful a lot, and I think the short answer is, food can be a good entry, an entry point to other cultures, but simply eating another culture's food doesn't suddenly make you an expert in it. And it's only can be the beginning of more exploration.
But it's a beginning.
Right.
It's a beginning.
Right. Absolutely.
On another note, I was in Italy in October a few years ago, and I get it. Everything comes ripe at the same time. The wheat, the tomatoes, the olives, the lemons, everything. We got to deal with this, man. What are we going to do? Okay, we're gonna dry it out. We're going to make noodles. We're going to put the tomatoes in cans. This is what we'll do. We'll put the olives in cans. It's going to be good. It's going to be fine. And I see where that culture emerges. And so fish, the type of fish you eat in sushi depends on the season, or it used to. Depend on the season. It's food brings people together, as you would point out.
Absolutely, absolutely. Have you tried preserved lemons?
Yeah, I think
this
so.
Is the thing that I've been getting into. Mm. Oh my god! You just like take a lemon, slice it in quarters without totally severing it, and just rub a bunch of salt all on the insides, and then smush. You do a bunch, and then smush them down into a jar, and smush to get the juice out. So that they're submerged in the liquid.
Submerged in lemon juice.
That's right. And then just let them sit on your counter for as long as you want. And the rinds will become soft and edible, and they develop a deep sort of fermented savoriness that is so satisfying. After about 8 months or a year, I finally put mine in the fridge, And now I'll just take like a tiny sliver of it and chop it up and blend it into something. And that one tiny sliver adds so much flavor. It's amazing.
Dan, you're
I think
are I'm, you okay?
I think I'm, you know, Dan, I think I might be old enough now that I'm ready to try that. So thank you.
Well said. Well said.
So Julie, thank you so much. I actually have to ask one question. Do you have children? Is that part of why you asked this question?
Well, I'm a school food service director, so I have like 2,500 kids. And I noticed there's a big shift between like elementary age kids and middle school age kids with what they want to eat. You know, the middle school age kids are all after the spicy, the buffalo, the sriracha, you know, and high school age kids. So, and personally, yeah, I do have kids myself. But yeah, there seems to be a giant shift when in the teenage years or early teens where they will be more adventurous. And I was wondering if there was a physiological, like if taste buds were diminishing or, you know, like super taster buds were falling away or something like that. But I don't know. It also could be peer pressure. Somebody sees somebody eat something spicy, so they give it a whirl.
Yeah. You guys, Dan, you have Julie, do you eat really spicy food, like chemically hot food?
Personally, yeah. I'm moderately spicy.
Because I know people that, well, you got to have 5 stars, man.
Yeah, that's annoying. Like, yeah. Spicy food should not be like feats of strength. Like, it's not a taste. It's not a test of your manhood or personhood to like withstand more spicy food. Like, you know, people should eat what they like.
Yeah.
And, okay. Julie, I would say, also I want to add, first of all, feeding 2,500 students. Oh my God. Like, thank you for your service. That sounds like the hardest job. But, I think that, you know, I have seen a little bit of research which suggests that younger kids tend to gravitate more towards sugar, and that as you enter puberty in your teen years, you tend to move away from sugar, that it's sort of a quick, cheap energy fix that you would gravitate towards as a little kid. And so I do feel that way. So this is anecdotal, but I do certainly, that was my experience. Like when you're a little kid, you think of like ice cream and candy, but like I don't remember my teen years being filled with sweets in the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. A great question. You sparked a lot of conversation here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's see. We have a question here. Evan, you're on the air. What is your question?
Is the celery juice craze fad or fact?
It's got to be a fad. But celery with salt? Oh, yes. Celery with peanut butter. Whoa!
And for some of us of a certain culture, Dr. Brown's celery tonic is delicious.
Celery tonic, right? And there is something called celery salt, which I think the celery part of that. I don't know who has ever actually tasted the celery in celery salt. But we did an episode of The Sporkful about the history of celery, and it turns out that celery, this is its second go around as a trendy vegetable. Back in the late 18 and early 1900s, celery was like the avocado toast, the kale of its time. Rich Victorian people in the Upper East Side of Manhattan would have celery vases. They would display their celery proudly. And Kalamazoo, Michigan was known as Celery City. It was like the hottest craze. And so all things old are new again.
So celery, if you like the taste of it, enjoy it.
Okay, so I think the upshot is, yes, it's a fad, but yes, it's delicious.
Just if they ask too much money for it, be skeptical.
And what's the next food trend?
Dan, what's the next food trend?
Oh, the next food. Well, what's a vegetable?
Kale.
Kale's probably on its way out. Celery is just coming up. What's a vegetable that like is really an also ran right now?
Arugula. I think we've arugued.
Yeah, that's done. I think iceberg lettuce.
Oh yeah,
I love iceberg. Gotta say, I was raised on it. Bring on the iceberg.
I think iceberg's gonna make a comeback.
There's your prediction. All that's right.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Will romaine lettuce ever make a comeback?
Romaine
is making a comeback, isn't it, as a holster of a frou-frou hors d'oeuvre.
Yes, but how do you feel, Bill, when you get a salad served to you? Let's say it's a Caesar salad, and they give you all the long stalks of romaine piled up like a pile of firewood almost. You can't fork one of those pieces of lettuce and get them into your mouth. You have to use a knife.
So, people, can I just speak briefly?
Please.
Okay. If you have a chopstick, where are you? You're nowhere, people. You need chopsticks. If you have a fork, you can get started. But the other side is the knife. The knife is the pusher. Not only is it the slicer, it is the backstop for forking. All right, people, people who are 12, 13, 14 years old, I explain this fundamental thing. There's the guy, what's his name? Archimedes. If I have a lever long enough and a place to stand, I can move the Earth. Without the place to stand, you ain't moving no planet. It's not happening. So when you're presented with the firewood pile of romaine, embrace the knife. Cut, push, poke, enjoy. Thank you for your question.
And I would just add, if you wait long enough, every single food will come back as a fad.
Thank you.
I love you, man. I'm Bill Nye, and I've been joined by Corey S. Powell. And today's guest has been none other than Dan Pashman from the Sporkful Podcast. Download it, subscribe to it, turn it up loud. And remember, when it comes to the palatable and potable part of our universe, science rules. If you like Science Rules, and I hope you do, please take a moment to rate and review it in Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. It helps us out and helps other people learn about the show so they too can turn it up loud. Thanks. Science Rules is produced by Jordan Bell. Our engineer today is Jared O'Connell. Mixing and original theme music were by Casey Halford. Our intern is Lisa Wang. Special thanks to Claire Rawlinson. Chris Bannon is the chief content officer of Stitcher, where science rules. Do you have a question? Is there something that's been bugging you, something you want to know about? Well, call us and leave a message, and Corey and I will do our best to answer your question on the air or on the podcast or on your recording device. Call us at 201-472-0785. 201-472-0785. Leave your fascinating question and Corey and I are going to get to it. 201-472-0785.
Stitcher.